Good afternoon, everybody. This is Lowland Cycling Talk. Today is Sunday, March 5th, 5 o'clock, regular time. We have Jack with us and Stuart. Good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Doing great. How are you, Jerry?
Doing pretty good.
Yeah, seconded, doing very well today.
Right. It's beautiful weather to be outside. Did you go
absolutely
out,
go outside
and definitely
ride? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, today we are the Trestle Bridge Racing Team, a local mountain bike team in the area, named after the Trestle Bridge in Downingtown, PA. We had our kind of start of the season kickoff, let's say, where we went on a nice gravel ride and came back in typical mountain bike fashion, ate some barbecue and some beer and hung out. Yeah, it was a lovely day to do it. A lot warmer than anticipated, which was nice.
Yeah, it was really good. How about you, yeah, Jack?
Actually, I did not get on the bike today.
Oh.
One of my goals last year, I did 10,000 miles and I was focused. I mean, that's all I did was ride my bike. And this year I said, you know what? You know, I love doing that 10,000. It was great, but I'm not going to be so all consumed because mm-hmm. I didn't do other things that we enjoy. So my wife and I went out to the Bryn Coed Preserve and did a wonderful like 5.5 mile hike. It
nice.
Was beautiful. Great. Took my camera, took some pictures. So yeah, so today was a day off the bike and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Right. Great. Hey, Jack, so when you do 10,000, how many of those miles are on the trainer, would you say?
Last year, I was able to, most of them were outdoor. It was about 2,500 on the trainer, about 2,500 on the trainer. So a quarter of those on the trainer.
Okay. From your experience, would you say it's 1 mile on the trainer is the equivalent of 1 mile on the road or?
You know, it's interesting.
Trainers like a mile on the road.
It's interesting. Some people call the trainer miles fake miles. I do not call them fake miles at all. the trainer will always overestimate speed. So, you know, when I'm on the road, I'm probably averaging between 17 and 19, something like mm-hmm. that. When I'm on the trainer, it's typically 20 to 23. Because you're typically in a group, so you're getting some draft, but you never coast on the trainer. Mm-hmm. You never coast on the trainer. So I'd say they're equivalent, you know, pedal stroke for pedal stroke. I'd say they're equivalent.
Yeah, I know. I've always been told by coaches, you know, if you do 45 minutes on the trainer, that's like an hour 10 on the roads.
Yeah, I would say that.
I said it last time on the, right, yep. I said about 30%, something like that. You always have the pressure on the pedal, right? There is, like Jack said, there's no coasting. It's like throwing an anchor overboard. If you stop pedaling, it's like you come to a mm-hmm. screeching halt on the trainer. So it's a different, you know, it's still good miles. And we were actually just talking about that, Jack, where people asked you last year, like, hey, Jack, how did you get into such good shape getting into the spring? And your answer was, you know, doing a lot of trainer rides and doing the
trainer
workouts.
Trainer rides and workouts, yeah. Yeah, there's the camp that sort of slogs their way through winter.
Right.
Getting a lot of base miles, and there's nothing wrong with a lot of base miles, but you really never, you know, never riding that hard in the winter because, you get overheated and then you get sweaty and then you freeze. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, people, you'll go into base miles mode in the winter. And like I said, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's also you're not really getting any high effort training, in there. So I think a combo is probably the best answer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, now I'm sure this could be an entire podcast about the right way to train in the winter time. But I know Jerry, who I talk to Jerry about everything I do, with training and, I don't do well in the winter and I don't like to ride outside a lot in the winter. And it, you know, this winter in Pennsylvania has been easy to do it, but most of the time I don't like to ride outside. And so I kind of switch it where this time of the year, I'm doing a lot of Zwift crits, 2 to 3 of them a week normally. because I don't want to be outside. So I'm only riding 5 to 6 hours a week, but two or three of those are very high intensity.
Yeah,
20, 30 minutes of intensity. And that's about it. I'll do a couple of those a week. And then come March, I'll switch it and typically start my longer riding. But this year I've been doing mainly all long riding. And I'm noticing in my body that right now I feel it's better than it has in a while. And I feel stronger, both from lifting, but also for the endurance miles. So, I see the standard periodization working out well, and right. The periodization working well.
Yeah, we have to talk about that in a future podcast. Mm-hmm. You see a lot about the quote unquote Norwegian way, you know, which is, you know, a form of the 80-20. But when I go back to my racing days, you know, 30 years ago, you were already doing base training, which is the same. I think maybe mm-hmm. the one difference is that it didn't have so much intensity. You were basically always stuck in that zone because that was the right thing to do at first with only a heart rate monitor. Mm-hmm. And otherwise it would be, you know, RPE basically, because we didn't have mm-hmm. all these great tools to help us with that. But Let's kick off with the agenda, because we have a lot on the agenda again. It's you know, the cycling world is relentless. There is so much coming all the time. So we'll start off with the race review. Obviously, a number of really exciting races this week and weekend. We have some cycling industry news, some media news. The tech corner is pretty loaded. And then we'll look at the next week. And we have also a guest interview lined up, which I think we are able to announce at the end of this podcast. So let's kick off with the race review. We started with Le Sommet. What do you think? It was on Tuesday, I believe, Stuart, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an exciting race. It's one of the mini classics I always look forward to watching. It has so many of the roads that are fun watching, and this year it didn't seem to disappoint. Although it's not the typical big names we normally see out there, it's still such a fun event. This year is won by Jerry will have to correct me here, Milan Menten, and he's from Lotto Destiny, and he did such a great job of riding the race, but really giving a pretty funny interview afterwards. I'm not sure if anybody watched this and caught it, but he dislocated his shoulder in his celebration of winning. And he cheered a little bit too crazy as his team said. I think his quote was, I braked as quickly as possible with my other hand and pushed everything into place. I now know how to do that because it's happened before. So like a true bike racer, you know, lower body invincible, upper body very invincible. He broke his shoulder celebrating. Right. But yeah, it was a fun race to watch.
Yeah. The thing which I find particular with that race is it shows really well the type of racing, because you have these very narrow country roads in, mm-hmm. you know, like you have in the Netherlands and Belgium, but they are still doing, you know, 25, 30 miles an hour. And you know, a lot of these wavy corners, and you have the road furniture, and you have these small towns that they blast through, and that, you know, that makes for really nervous racing, mm-hmm. Then getting on the cobblestones. And you know, this race more than others, you really see that come to display.
A little different than the UAE Tour, where everything's on grand.
yes.
Yeah, there were a lot of crashes throughout the mm-hmm. day, and Fabio Jakobsen, he hit the ground pretty hard, and he got knocked out of contention. There were a few others as well that got knocked out of contention. But one thing along the way, did you guys see Victor Campenaerts, the front cog he was running on his chainring? I think he was running a 60-tooth chainring. He's somebody we were talking about it before, classified. They didn't specifically say during the broadcast that he was using a classified hub, but they talked a lot mm-hmm. about how he was running a one-by because of the hub. And they were mentioning a lot of the people who were involved in the startup that he was riding, and which I'm fairly certain is classified, which we talked about last week.
Right, exactly.
But he wasn't mentioned by name, but I'm almost positive that's what it was. And yeah, he was running a 60 tooth chain ring up front. Just, I mean, crazy. Even if he has the classified that allows him to go down, I mean, it's still that's a big chain ring.
Yeah, that's time trial, the time trial size. Yeah, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
it huge. Is, but
yeah, that's huge.
But it's showing what these bikes can do. If you can run an internal rear hub that allows the front chain ring to run that 60, and then you run on an Eagle 1042 cassette on the rear, you can have a 60 front end if the internal of the classified drops that down to, I don't know what their gear ratios allow. They haven't really talked about that yet from what I've seen, but let's say you can drop down to a 36. I mean, that's a massive change.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It's interesting because Campenaert, he's one of these. You have a few guys in the peloton that are always experimenting with, you know, new stuff. And he's mm-hmm. one of those. Remember last year, I don't know exactly which race it was, but it was like a regular setup, but his mm-hmm. front chain ring was, I don't think it was a 60, but it was, I don't know, it was a really big front ring. Yeah. And that was because of the descents. He wanted to get that speed and he was mm-hmm. trying to, you know, break away using that bigger mm-hmm. front chain ring. So it's interesting that these guys are, you know, they're so passionate about cycling, but they also are looking for some competitive advantage by using that technology.
Yeah, totally. And for those who don't know who Victor Campenaert is, he was the hour record holder. He held it for several months before it was broken. So he is a time trialist expert. He's Belgium, as I believe. Yep. And time trialist. And as Jerry said, he really looks at the tech and looks into the marginal gains. Has Sky ruined that term for everybody? But that's what he looks into. And he's one of the people at the forefront of that, as Jerry said. And he's a fun racer because he's in that Taco Vanderhorn field of anything that they can do to be faster, they will do regardless of what the norms are or what convention says. They're looking for that extra thing. I'm sure he's somebody who's been hit with the Sox penalty as well at some point.
Right. And that's actually maybe a good bridge to the, because I believe that Mahorić rode with a dropper post in Strade Bianche.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He switched his bike at some point, but initially he started off with riding with a dropper post. But so that's a good intro into the main event, both women and men, the Strade Bianche. That was, both races were pretty cool. Pretty cool, you know, some controversy on, you know, in team aspects and some other, you mm-hmm. know, awkward stuff that happened. Jack, what was your, if we start with the women's race, what were a couple of the highlights for you?
Yeah, I'm a big Puk Pedersen fan. So just to see her in her second road race ever do so well, that's great. Mm-hmm. I think that's fantastic. One of the big takeaway is that the team tactics in both of those races were questionable.
Right.
And I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit further. But it was a little odd watching both. But interestingly, you know, Stuart, we'll see which one you like the best, because I think you like the you're not quite the fan of the solo to the win.
This week I've changed though, Jack.
Oh, really?
Because he had such a slim margin.
Was so.
For those who haven't watched, spoiler alert, Tom Pidcock won the men's. We haven't talked about that yet, but he was a spectacular solo breakaway. But I'm saying I switched last week. I didn't like Van Barle's quite as much, because that was like a minute and a half, 2 minutes almost, and 60K romp. While this was Tom Pidcock never had more than 30 seconds. Maybe it ballooned up to 40 when they were really
down. Wasn't it down to eight? Six or eight, so or something close. Like that? Yeah.
It was so exciting. It was so exciting. But to touch back on the women's for what Jerry was saying as well, there was a little bit of controversy. So for those who didn't watch it, American Kristen Faulkner, she got a pretty significant gap at one point. It was about a minute 50, almost 2 minutes long. And she was just, I mean, she's a time trialist. She, if you don't know her, she's gotten leads in races before and has held on to yellow jerseys because of her ability to suffer. And she is a very strong cyclist. And it really wasn't until the final climb that she got pulled back. So Demi Vollering from SD Works, she went on the attack to try to bridge up, and she had a pretty hearty gap. I don't think it's a surprise to anybody to say that Lotto Capecchi is on form and it could be the strongest woman right now in the world tour. And she bridged up to Demi Vollering on her own, did a great job in terms of that. She didn't allow anyone to come along with her. She went solo and she made the gap.
Right.
But the two of them worked together to bring back Kristen Faulkner on the final climb up that final hill was where they caught her. And I don't know if it was Kristen Faulkner was just so in the pain cave that she had no idea what was going on. And she was like going back and forth, and she ended up putting Demi Vollering into the side about twice. The barriers two times in a row. I think unintentionally, just she was worked. But Vollering did a great job of backing off, letting Kristen, you know, make her, and then coming up around the side of her. And Demi and Lotto Capecchi battled right to the finish line. And I thought for sure, I don't know about you guys, but I thought for sure going up that final climb, and when it was clear it was going to be SD Works winning,
right?
I thought it was going to be Demi Vollering, just, you know, no questions asked. I thought she was going to win. Mm-hmm. But then Lotto Capecchi started attacking. I hope they had some sort of conversation. Did you guys see them talk about it ahead of time at all? Or
a lot of coverage, obviously, both sides on the Belgium TV and on the, you know, in the news, and on the Dutch side of right, because Demi Vollering is Dutch, Lotto Capecchi is from Belgium, and so you hear the two sides. But I think the one thing that they do agree on, there were no agreements made. Demi Vollering did think that she was supposed to win because she had, and everybody thinks that's a really awkward, you know, way of thinking, because she finished first on the climb. She figured, okay, now I deserve to win. And she was surprised that Lotto Capecchi still, you know, did the sprint at the very end.
Interesting.
But, you know, you saw it at the body language, the way they were not looking at each other, not congratulating each other. Even after the race interviews, it was quite awkward, awkward situation. Yeah.
At least in the women's race, it didn't cost them the win, where I think the team tactics in the men's race might have impacted the finish for the
I'll results. Agree.
Yeah, results.
Yeah.
What'd you think about the horse incident?
Yeah. Jerry did some research. The horse is all right. Is that right?
Yeah, the horse is fine. That
are we breaking news? Are we breaking news right now?
she is on antibiotics, but she's doing well. The horse's name is what's her name again? Slatana, and she's doing well. So if people were wondering, she has not turned into a steak yet. So, the owner of the horse was very apologetic. He went on Facebook and he offered up his excuse. It's a great photo.
It is. Yeah. For those of you again who weren't watching, in the women's race, as Demi Vollering was chasing down Kristen Faulkner, probably had her within sights a minute or so, let's say, on a horse who had a halter and bridle and lead line on, got loose, clearly freaking out from everything that was going on, and ran onto the road in front of Demi And eventually in a turn where Demi was turning left, the horse went straight into a driveway and ended up crashing the horse. Luckily, as Jerry said, is okay, which is good because for those that are not horse people, horses falling can lead to breaking legs. Oh, yeah. And horses don't recover from breaking a leg. Unfortunately, as myself, I lived above a horse barn for 13 years of my life. I know firsthand they don't live from that. So yeah. Great to hear.
Yeah,
great,
absolutely.
Hear.
So, and Demi was shook by that.
How can you not be?
Horse, yeah,
you
really.
Know, a big horse. So she was like screaming, like she was somewhat panicking. You know, what's interesting? You know, she was closing in, so the lead was to Faulkner was still 1:20 back then, and. When the whole horse incident happened, it was back to the back. The gap was bigger, you know, close to 1:40. So, would Kopecky have bridged up to her if the horse incident wouldn't have happened? Right, because then the gap would still have been bigger between Demi Vollering and Kopecky, and you know, now. Kopecky, when she bridged, she could see Demi Vollering basically in the distance. But if it's, you know, instead of 20 seconds, it's 40 seconds, that's basically a no-no, right? You don't bridge up to your fellow teammate. So, you know, that's, we'll never know. But that might have been an impact of the horse being out on the course.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, back to Jack's initial point, though, Puck Peterson, man, that girl, yeah. I can't wait. And I hope, I know Femme Van Empel from Jumbo-Visma is focusing on mountain bikes. I know Puck does a lot of mountain bikes, but I hope the two of them can kind of grow the way that Matthew and Wout have for the women's side. I mean, I personally find women's cycling equally as exciting as the men's. I will turn on a women's race anytime it's on.
Yep.
And if they are there, I will definitely be watching them race.
Right.
Those two. Those are must watch TV.
Yeah. See, it was so impressive to see her ride. And I honestly didn't expect it to be that case, her being in the front like that. Mm-hmm. Basically riding at the same level as Annemiek van Vleuten. I do think that Annemiek van Vleuten is not in the form yet that she would like to be or should be. But she's only 20, nearly 21 years old. So, you know, her future is bright. And like Jack said, it was her second race. And she was, when Demi Vollering and Kopecky took off together with Van Vleuten, she was pulling. They were turning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other lady, and it's so annoying because I see her do it all the time. From, I believe she's from Switzerland. What's her name again?
Talking about
Ludwig.
Yeah.
She's just sucking wheel all the time. And often she gets really good results. So it's not that she can't take a turn. She absolutely can, but she's always sucking wheels.
Are you thinking of Cecile Ludwig from FDJ? Ludwig.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one.
Or is it Cecile Utrecht-Ludwig?
Utrecht-Ludwig, yes, correct. So, and she's a great rider, but she just doesn't take her turns, and that's,
smart.
Smart.
She's smart.
Yeah.
I find it annoying.
I'm sure the rest of the peloton does as well.
Right.
How could you not?
Right. So,
but yeah, I mean, the women's race, it was really exciting. So at the end... you know, I don't know if we actually said it, but Demi Vollering ended up actually in a photo finish with Lotto Kopecky, ended up being awarded the win. I never saw anything that showed who did or did not win. But regardless, Demi Vollering with the win, with Lotto Kopecky in second and Kristen Faulkner, the American, in third. And then, you know, as you said, Puck Peterson was right there. I think she was around sixth or so. But it was so much fun to watch her push it when Annemiek went. Right. Puck Peterson was on her wheel, was willing to up at one, which was awesome to see such a young badass out there.
Right.
And then on to, I don't know if I'm wrong in saying the main show, the men's race, shortly thereafter, Let's just cut to the chase. Tom Pidcock won in dominant fashion. And I do not think there is a better bike handler in the men's Peloton.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Oh my
maybe
gosh.
Puck Peterson could give him a run for his money as best overall, you know, with her one-handed wheelies. But realistically, the way he really bridged up. So Tom Pidcock was back in the main group. There was a breakaway. They had about 2 minutes when he went. And man, when Pidcock went, he bridged up to one group and then another group, and he was unbelievable.
Right. It was 50K to go. I believe it was Bettiol who later had a really nasty crash that really looked very not good.
No.
It was a Bettiol with Baggioli from Quickstep.
Yep. And Pidcock bridged up to them.
Yep.
Also at that moment, again, I don't know, it just catches my eye, and the camera obviously also, but you know, Sagan got dropped immediately. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't in contention anymore. And a little bit later, when all the groups were spread out, you know, it's very hilly. There was this shot of Alaphilippe, who was in, you know, a third or a fourth group. So he got dropped. And
Pidcock going downhill on gravel, watching that bike just float. I mean, yep. It was all over the place, and you know, he just lets it go. He doesn't panic; he just lets it go. And he descending on gravel was an art form.
It really is. And it's something that you don't see most road riders being willing to accept as the bike sliding under you. You know, that is truly, I'm not as much of a cross racer. I would consider myself a pure mountain biker, and in mountain biking is something where almost every turn your wheels are going to be braking a little bit, like braking with their traction a little bit in almost every turn. Cross definitely as well. So such an advantage for somebody like Pidcock to have that. And you could really see him accepting, as Jack was saying, accepting the bike moving under him. And he kept his butt floating a few inches above it and let the saddle kind of flop from inner thigh to inner thigh, where you apply the pressure with the outside leg GP Moto style. Pidcock closed almost a 2 minute gap over the main gravel section. And he was flying.
Right. Yeah, and on his downhill skills a little bit more, right? So he did have, you know, one or two, you know, where he skidded, but it doesn't faze him. He just keeps on going. Mm-hmm. There's really not even a split second where he, you know, readjusts. No, he just takes it and just keeps on going, which is really amazing. And you saw that with, you know, the his TT bike adventure, where he basically rode up the sidewall of that small hill, kept on going. But and even you have to look it up, the on the training camp where he goes downhill. You know, you see it over social media everywhere. Even there, he had, you know, a kind of very awkward moment, but he just steps on it and keeps
going.
Well,
hell, even last year in the Tour de France, on the Alpe d'Huez stage, epic. He won where he almost went into the barriers on when he was catching back up to Spencer Palace, who was off the front, you know, when they were descending. He almost put himself into the barriers, but it didn't faze him, to your point, at all.
Right.
You know, he makes I don't know if a mistake's the right word, but the bike might get a little squirrely, or he might get a little close to something, and he doesn't think about it. He moves on and continues riding his bike, and he's phenomenal.
Right.
What a badass.
Yeah.
Yeah. In car terms, it's the difference between a road racer and a WRC car. You know, I mean, the WRC guys are sliding all over creation all the time, where a road racer, you're supposed to keep the all four tires kind of planted. And just the analogy, I think, is spot on, because he does not care if his wheels are planted at all. He just deals with it. He knows how to deal with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. So then you had the Marquee and Bistrom still in front. So like you said, he bridged to that gap, but then you had that's how quick the difference was made. So Pidcock was 24 seconds, and then the group with Benoot and Van der Poel, which, you know, was shrank to 15, 20 people, was already at 1 minute 24. That was... That was very, very quick. And
The cameras, they seem to have a little bit of trouble keeping track of the exact time gaps, which is understandable when you're on gravel that, where you have somebody like Pidcock who has to actually break for the motos in front of him. But to your point, he bridged up to DeMarkey and I forget the other person that was with him off the front, but then Alexander DeMarkey, he held on to him for a little while, and then with about 23 kilometers to go is about when Pidcock ended up dropping him. And that's about when the Jumbo-Visma train started to run into some problems between Walter, the Hungarian champion, and Thijs Benoot, the Belgian. The two of them could not seem to figure out how to work together. And I don't know who's right. I don't know what was said ahead of time, but it looked to me like Thijs Benoot was not really understanding what was going on, because Walter looked like he was able to bridge up to the Benoot group pretty easily and by himself, and he dropped everybody out and he got up there. But you see on camera Benoot being like, WTF are you doing? Right. And maybe Benoot couldn't see that there was a pretty substantial gap behind Walter. I don't actually know. I haven't heard anything. For those of you who don't know, Jerry's originally from the Netherlands, so he speaks the language and is able to follow some of those overseas. Jerry, did you see anything over there that we don't necessarily see about what happened between the two of them, or any miscommunications or anything?
No, it was the same, but it's, you know, initially they said, hey, did we see that correctly? Basically Benoit throwing up his arm and you know, waving him away like what are you doing, right? You're bridging up to me. And then following that, it was very clear that they were upset with each other. And they were not communicating at all. And it was actually very weird, because sometimes it looked that Benoit had the upper hand, being the better guy. And the other time, the other guy felt better and just took off, and it looked like the deciding, you know, bridge or you know, creating a gap between themselves, and then he was caught back. So it was very weird, just almost like wasting energy compared to, you know, do communicating and figuring it out and saying, hey, and what about, you know, the team leader in the car?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a lot of that's the director. I mean, they should say, look, you guys work together, you finish it out and you figure it out in the last 3K or something of that nature, but or on the last climb, but work together to bring back Pidcock. Because if they work together, they were within 8 seconds. They could see him. I mean, if they continued to work together, I think if the two of them worked together, the rest of that group would have also worked more together. And I think they had every opportunity, every chance to catch Pidcock, but, you know, they were pretty much fighting each other from the moment they bridged back up together over several kilometers, you know, several tens of kilometers. And they just, I think, you know, you got to go back to the director in the car going, what do you know, you're supposed to be giving these guys some type of leadership, I would think.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder how much of it comes down to a language barrier.
Yes, I was about to say that.
I know this is Thijs's second year with Jumbo-Visma. I know Walter is Hungarian, and this is his first year with them. I don't know if language might be a huge problem, all honesty. Weird as it is to say on such a professional team, of like the most professional team right now in cycling, to have something like that be an issue. But yeah, what else really could it have been?
Right. I don't know, you know, what his English language skills are, but for example, if you have somebody from Hungary, like Kata Blanka Fass, you know, the mm-hmm. elite rider from Hungary, also very good in cyclocross. Mm-hmm. Her English is not good.
Yep. So I've heard maybe she's on SD Works now, isn't she?
She is. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yes.
And I've heard that as well, that, you know, that there is a language barrier with her. Right. Yeah.
So maybe that's it. And he's obviously very young, but you know, if you've been cycling for a while, there are certain, you know, rules that translate without having to use any language. And but it kind of, you know, there are some hairline fractures in the Jumbo Visma, you know.
Yeah, we were talking about them being so dominant last weekend, exactly. and they obviously were. And, you know, this weekend they didn't look quite as crisp.
Right. Hmm. No, but, and then part of that's, you know, that they might have lacked that true big leader, while I guess Tiche would have been the official leader of the team for the weekend, and especially in a race that he's won before. He won the 2018 edition when it was that absolute mud fest. Where I think the unfortunate video of Wout Van Aert cramping up so hard in the final climb up to Plaza de Campo, where he has to get off his bike, comes from. So it makes sense that Tiche would have been the leader, but yeah, I think we're all kind of in agreement there that the reaction didn't seem to make sense.
Right. It does beg the question that Pidcock win the race, or did Jumbo lose the race? Right? Could they have bridged the gap if they would have been working together? And would Pidcock then still be able to, you know, do what he did and win the race? Because again, it was so close, right? It was only 6, 7, 8 seconds.
Yeah,
they could see him. They could literally see him.
When they got within sight distance, I thought for sure that he was going to, but then he just descended. They started messing around with each other, and it went from, you know, 6 to 8 seconds to 20 seconds, you know, almost ballooned instantaneously. Quickly. Yeah, mm-hmm.
I am in the camp that Pidcock won that race because he threw caution into the wind and said, you know what? And I think his post-race even said, you know, he wasn't anticipating, that wasn't the plan to go from that far, but it's what unfolded. And then he kind of was like, well, I'm here. I'm going to keep on going. And then he kept on thinking he was about to be brought back. So I'm definitely going with both. Can I answer? Is both Jumbo Visma lost the race by Pidcock winning it? Can that, you know, because they really did. I mean, they should have been able to pull him back, but
you know,
one of them should have sacrificed for the other.
It doesn't take anything away from his win, because he
100%
deserved it, right? Yeah. In the descent, and if you look at, you know, the pictures, he was pulling all the time. When he was still had the two guys with him, he was pulling. There's nothing stolen, nothing, you know, he 100% deserved this win. Yeah.
Absolutely.
100%.
Agree.
And then the final two parts I think we want to talk about, and I don't even know if they're fair to say, but the disappointing is not quite the right word, but Alaphilippe and Matthew Vanderpoel are two people that we, you know, have such high esteem of, especially with what they put on last year. Yep. I still think Matthew's explosions from last year are two of the most impressive displays of power I've ever seen.
Right.
So for neither one of them to really be in contention was a little bit disappointing, but at the same time, not totally unexpected.
Right. So one, and this is what they are talking about, you know, in the Belgium and Dutch media, is the Jumbo Visma team, right? They have been living on a mountain at altitude. They come down the mountain and they win. Right, Mathieu van der Poel has been doing the same, but apparently he does need a couple of races to come back and win. Mm-hmm. Right, so he needs, and that's also what he said in the media, that he needs a couple of races to get into that racing toughness. So he's missing that. And he actually said, "I didn't feel bad at all, but I just didn't have that extra that you need to win this race." So he was quite positive, actually. And but the other thing that I do think is very important is that I believe his team isn't as strong as previous years.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Sam Gaze was up there, the mountain biker. But yeah, there were not many of them. I think I recall seeing two teammates around him. Sam Gaze, I'm not sure who the other one was. But yeah, they're not.
And but they were, as soon as it exploded 50K, you know, then they were gone. And, you know, they're missing somebody like Tim Merlier or maybe even Jay Vine or guys that can help Van der Poel a little bit more, to help to bridge the gap. Because that was, and obviously my eye is always caught on, you know, where is Mathieu Van der Poel? And they were... they were eating his lunch, mm-hmm. right? He was the guy always trying to, when somebody, you know, took off, he was bridging it because everybody was looking at him. And then another one took off and he was trying to, and he didn't make it even, right? So that's something that you don't see that often. And that just showed that he isn't in best form yet. But you know, he was burning matches and the other was, but just looking at him, and you know, do your best. And they were serving him. Yep. Okay, cool. So yeah, very exciting.
I need a quick step away.
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
Okay. So
it's been a great race.
Yeah, it was an amazing race. And then let's talk a little bit about the next week races. One actually already started today. That's Paris-Nice. They call it the Race to the Sun because obviously they start in Paris and then they ride all the way down south towards south. The
yep.
sun.
Yep.
And it's a stage race and it started today and it finishes on March 12th. So that eight stages, two flat, two hilly, one flat with an uphill finish. There is a team time trial, and there are two mountain stages. So it's got a little bit of everything. But you know, the one thing that is new and I haven't seen before is that for the team time trial, the actual individual time counts. So normally it's the team time and you need to crush the finish line with four riders and they all get the same time. Now it's the individual time. So Stuart, we're talking about
that'll change the tactics, won't it?
We're talking about the team time trial, but the individual time counts, which I think is very interesting to see, right? Because that's so different than it used to be. Because now, I don't know, you could see Pogačar take off 3 miles before the finish and finish 20 seconds in front, and that time still counts for him compared to
him and one teammate could sacrifice themselves. Yeah.
So that's going to be that's absolutely a stage that I'm looking forward to.
That's a great addition and change.
Right, and then the first stage was today, sprint stage. But what was very interesting was that it was there were a couple of small climbs, and on the last climb, I think it was 3 or 4 miles before the finish, there was a time bonus at the top. And Pogačar actually took the 6 seconds time bonus. Vingegaard jumped with him. He didn't get any time. And then it was Vingegaard, Pogačar, and somebody else. They tried to stay in front, but Vingegaard wasn't cooperating. He wasn't taking any turns because he had Olaf Coy, the sprinter, obviously in the group chasing behind them. It got back together, and it ended up being a sprint where Tim Merlier, he won. Bennett K came in second, and it was Pedersen, Coy, and DeLee, the young guy. He came in fifth, I believe. But, you know, that shows that Tim Merlier, he won, and obviously Alpecin De Koning now is betting on Jasper Philipsen. But, you know, I'm kind of scratching my head like Tim Merlier. Wasn't he the better pick, but, you know.
Yeah, Tim Merlier, he's really come on. He's become quite the sprinter. And is his true lead out there is Michael, I'm blanking on his last name.
Morkov?
His main, Morkov. Is Morkov there?
I'm not sure. He might have even retired because he was Cavendish's lead out.
No, Morkov is still there.
Is he still there?
He is, yeah. Okay. Yeah. This part we might need to cut out, Jerry. But yeah, I think Morkov is there. I'm pretty sure Michael Morkov is still part of their team. I'll quickly look up who's racing there.
Right. Yeah. So that's but you had Sam Bennett, who was also pretty. It was a pretty close finish with that lead in. So there was a great stage, and then. Tomorrow we have Tirreno Adriatico starting too. So that's in Italy, also a stage race. And that starts tomorrow and finishes the 12th. That's going to be interesting too, because like in Paris-Nice, you have Pogacar against Vinigo. You know, battling it out. That will be very interesting. But in the Tirreno Adriatico, you have Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert. And if you recall, I don't think it was last year, but the year before, where Mathieu van der Poel and van Aert were just each and every stage, they were, you know, battling it out. It was absolutely epic. You had that one stage where van der Poel went with 50K to go, and he was chased down by Pogacar, and Pogacar came really, really close. Vanderpool just made it.
Was that when he was cold and had a bar in his mouth when he decided to attack?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He was bored. Yeah. He was cold.
He was bored and cold.
Yeah. I'm going. See ya. And he won, but, you know, he later committed that, you know, he put in too much energy during that Tirreno Adriatico because, you know, it felt like he, you know, there wasn't a day that he wasn't attacking. And, you know, even for somebody like Mathieu van der Poel, it was a little bit too much. Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a question that is not on our agenda. In Paris-Nice, we have Jonas Vingegaard and Tadej Pogacar and Tim Merlier, et cetera. In Tirreno Adriatico, we have Wout, we have Matthew, we have Enric Mas, we have Roglic, we have all of these guys. What is the bet? We have Alaphilippe, we have Barguil, we have Gianluca Brambilla. We have so many at both of these races. What is the better race right now, Paris-Nice or Tirreno Adriatico? Man, such good choices.
But you can ask that questions from two perspectives, right?
Yep.
For the audience, which is the better one to watch, but also then for the riders, which is the better one to prepare you for, you know, the classics that are coming, and or, you know, the Giro or the Tour de France, even, right? If I would put myself in the mind of a, you know, pro racer, I believe that the Tirreno Adriatico usually has a little bit better weather. Paris-Nice, you know, when I think back of, you know, earlier versions, the weather could be really, really bad, rainy, cold, until they get further down south, obviously. But that's the only thing that I could gain up, because from a stages point of view, I think they are comparable. You know, it's a little bit flat. It's a time trial or a team time trial. Some mountain stages. It's a good
But it is. Sounds like the biggest GC contenders decided on Paris-Nice, and the classics riders decided on Torino Adriatico.
Right.
Yeah. Not too far off. And for those looking to watch both of those races, Torino Adriatico, that's on GCN Plus, and the Paris-Nice is on. I watch it through Peacock app. I guess that's NBC is through one of their sports networks.
Right. Do you like Peacock?
I don't dislike it. Quite honestly, if I have the option to watch a European commentator, I will typically do that. Maybe that's just being an American and I like the sound of Carlton Kirby or their voices better. I like the English accent over the American accent, I think. Maybe it's also that you guys over there know how to actually pronounce the names as opposed to us over here, Chris Hornery. Butchering, we don't want to give you, it's Chris Hornery, the ultimate butcher.
So that's, those are races to look forward to. Okay, good stuff. So let's go on to the next topic. So we had some industry and media news. We will add the links to the podcast notes where you're looking on YouTube, because we started to throw these very handsome faces on YouTube too, or whether you are listening it on one of your favorite podcast platform, we'll make sure to add all the links of the topics to the notes, so you can click on them yourself. But Netflix, the Tour de France series is coming, so there is a preview, a teaser out there, which looks really good, and it's really modeled following the success recipe of Drive to Survive, the Formula One series, which really uplifted, especially in the US, Formula One racing. And they are looking, hopefully, to get similar success with cycling and the Tour de France. And that, you know, that preview, that teaser really looks promising.
Yeah, I hope it is. I mean, it's the behind the scenes interviews and all the information on the Drive to Survive really captured the U.S. market. I mean, if you think of prior to Drive to Survive, there was one Formula One race annually, and that was the one in Texas. This year, there's three: the one in Texas, one in Miami, and one on the Vegas Strip. So, and that's, primarily all because of the popularity of the Drive to Survive miniseries or Netflix series. So, if this can do the same for cycling, it's fantastic. I'm really, really hoping that it takes off.
I'm hopeful as well.
Right. Yeah. And what we mentioned is the Jumbo Visma series on Amazon. That will be coming too. So that's another one that I'm looking forward to. Some other news, which is unfortunately sad news again, and it just happens too often. And I don't know if it has to do actually with the popularity of cycling in the US. So there are more cyclists on the road, but too often you see in the news that cyclists are injured. And in this case, two cyclists got killed after a driver rides into a group of cyclists. This one was in Arizona. And it's just so sad. There were about 20 members of the local cycling club, and the driver, a pickup truck driver, crashed into them, injuring 11 and killing two, which is just so sad. So, for everybody, when you're out on the road, just be careful. It's It's,
ride it's like you're wearing spandex and you will get run over easily. I always ride with the mentality that nobody knows I'm there and nobody cares I'm there and that I'm a guy in spandex. And
Yeah. And it was a couple of weeks ago, even here locally, I think the poor guy was 75 years old.
And unfortunately, that one was hit by a police officer.
By a police officer, right. And there was a road, you know, crossing, and, you know, he was... So, you know, again, it's make sure that, that you do everything looking at it from a visibility point of view.
Yep.
Like your tail light, really bright colors. You might look silly. It's probably not the most fashionable thing that you can wear, but if it will save you from, you know, getting hit, you know,
Jerry, wait. You mean wearing neon yellow spandex as a 40-year-old man is not cool?
Maybe in the 90s, but
right. I'll tell you, that's one of the reasons I like the local club kit is that it's really visible.
It's really visible.
Really visible. I think it's reasonably tasteful too, but it's just super visible.
It is.
We were I was riding with the group and we all had our kits on, and we're going around this corner and there was a pickup truck sitting at the corner, and, you know, like you usually do, we wave just to make sure he saw us, whatever. And he calls out the window. He goes, "What do you think? I'm blind." So
that's actually a compliment, right? Yeah.
I said, that's an absolute compliment to our kit. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that's, you know, the waving, the eye contact. Actually, that's, you know, anecdote. I was back in the Netherlands. So, you know, accidents also happen not only in the US, but also in the Netherlands. I was commuting to work, was early in the morning, and this guy drives up, and I, you know, I'd ride off road, and I look him in the eyes. And I'm just as I'm, and he brakes because there was a T junction. So he was making a right turn. And he brakes. I look him in the eyes, you know, and I am in front of his car, and he pulls up. So I'm lying on, in the front on his hood. He slams the brake, so I get launched off of his hood on the middle on the on, oh, on the geez. Road. And then he had his window even open because it was a, you know, early morning summer day. So I jump up and I raise my fist, start walking towards him. First thing that he does is close his window.
Thinking, is this Sasquatch going to beat me up?
Yes. Jeez. Yeah. What is this maniac who I just hit? He just got out of his night shift. Right. So he had been working for, I don't know, 12 hours. He wasn't, he was trying to get home and he wasn't paying attention. You know, again, we had eye contact. I had right away. And he still hit me. And luckily, you know, he launched me onto the crossroads. No other traffic was there because otherwise it would have been more ugly. But again, even with eye contact, but, you know, these are the rules. That you need to follow. And I would like to highly recommend, not, you know, because it was our podcast, but we did record a podcast with Joey Piscitello, and that was podcast 37, and he's a lawyer and specializes in for cyclists and accidents, and he has.
And
you know,
do you mind
so
if I jump in? I unfortunately have had to use Joey about in 2021. I was hit in a roundabout. It was not my fault. I was hit side on, and similar to what Jerry was saying, I dented their hood, broke their windshield, had time to look through the windshield that I was breaking at the woman's face. It was hitting me before she slammed on the brakes and sent me through the air before I broke my helmet in half. I guess luckily the hockey player in me popped up right off the ground and was ready to fight somebody before I realized, you know, that, hey, I'm injured. But yes, Joey Piscitello as well. He, Piscitello from Piscitello Law. He works with me here, in Pennsylvania. I don't know if he's licensed outside of Pennsylvania, but he's phenomenal. he worked with me to get me my money for my bike. It was a brand new bike, about $10,000 to replace it, plus for me to replace my kit that was all destroyed. Unfortunately, I work in real estate, so I'm not an hourly employee. So, you know, figuring out lost wages was a little bit harder of a thing, but he worked with me phenomenally, and I'm very thankful for him and his law firm's time.
Absolutely. So please go ahead and listen that one. Highly recommend it. I guarantee you will have a couple of takeaways that you haven't considered to date. So, okay. So then we have some tech news left, and that's really your corner, Jack. So where do you want to start with the new Shimano group set? Is that
yeah? We have a couple of new group sets, one from Shimano and one from SRAM. But let's start with Shimano. Shimano released what they called Qs, and Qs stands for Creative Unique Experiences. So the C, the U, the E, and the S. And it's a new range of mid-range 9, 10, and 11-speed drivetrain components. It's scheduled to replace, on the flat bar side of the equation, 10 and 11 speed Dior, Alvivio, Acera and Altus. And you know, they haven't announced this, but on the drop bar is pretty clear that it's going to replace Tiagra, Sora, and Claris road group sets. And what I find interesting about this is that the cassette spacing, the chains, the cable pull ratios are all shared across components. Mm. So that's really unique. Up until this point in time, the rear spacing on a 9, a 10, an 11, and a 12-speed cassette were all different, which meant the cable pulls had to be different, means the chain widths had to be different. So they're unifying all of that right now. So everything will be based upon their Shimano Link Guide technology, and it will be compatible across all of those group sets. Now that probably doesn't mean a lot to the end consumer, but think if you're a bike shop owner. I mean, now all those pieces are interchangeable. So where before you had to have, you know, you had to have special tools, you had to have the right components, you couldn't put the levers from one brake group onto a bike that had different brake groups, or excuse me, a different shifting components. So it unifies all of that. And I just think it's going to be really helpful for bike shop owners, and it's more geared towards not the consumer, but for the manufacturer and the bike shop owner. I think it's going to revolutionize the industry from that perspective.
But
agreed. So I mean, it will make it so much easier for somebody to know. They won't need to go in there with like, well, I had this style chain running on this style cassette, you know. That really will be very easy for both, because then the consumer won't need to know all these different dialects that they need to know about this and that. Yeah. You know, they'll be able to just go and say, "Hey, I need this." That'll make it a lot easier.
Right. I would actually also say that it's very customer friendly because it's much more standardized, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And for depending on the margins, etc., but it actually could reduce some revenue, because you don't have to upgrade your whole bike when you want to change out one component anymore.
Right.
If you break your levers in a crash or something else, you drop your bike and you want to, let me upgrade it, but you can't because it's an 8-speed or a 9-speed. Mm-hmm. You're basically stuck, so you have to find it. That doesn't happen anymore, right? You can, it's more flexible, at least it seems.
Yeah.
But would this then also work for, you have an older bike, 20 years old, it's a 9-speed. You could potentially upgrade it with this group set? Is that?
Well, I don't think it's backward compatible, but yeah, you could upgrade it with the group, with the new group set, and then you have flexibility after that upgrade to, let's say you want to initially go to, you have a 9-speed, you're comfortable with that, you want to go to another 9-speed. If you upgrade to a Q's 9-speed, you can then later upgrade to an 11-speed.
Right.
And not replace everything.
Exactly.
You know, you got to replace one lever and a cassette. That's it. Your right. chain works, your wheel works, your derailleur works. It's really, I think, makes a lot of sense. And from mm-hmm. Shimano's perspective, I have to believe it's easier to manufacture too, because everything's based upon a standard.
Yeah.
Versus having everything be different. So I think that's a step in the right direction for sure.
Right.
Yes, I agree.
SRAM's also announcing a new group set, the new version of a second generation of SRAM Force. It's just basically called SRAM Force AXS. And you know, it's got a full range of configuration. So mm-hmm. this will work in double chain ring. It'll work in single chain ring. It'll work with, you know, with wide versus the traditional.
Now we were talking about end user convenience, and this is where SRAM really, really hits it on the head with exactly what you're talking about. How with a configuration like that, this, it can be a 1x, it can be a 2x.
Right.
Absolutely. You can have a SRAM 4 shifting set with a SRAM Eagle 1x42 derail or 10x42 cassette derail your combo. You know, I'm a Shimano person on my road bikes, and right now I have Shimano GRX, and I have to get some additional thing from Wolftooth Components in order, if I want to run a bigger cassette. The fact that SRAM allows everything to work together mm-hmm. in a unified family environment is awesome, and Shimano is the opposite. Shimano is like, if GRX can't talk to Autegra, or can talk to Autegra, but they can't talk to XTR or XT, and to see SRAM doing this and expanding upon it's great.
Well, one can only hope that they take cues from cues and take that yes. to their other group sets right. as well. Absolutely, it'd be great, because I've got a GRX as well, but I can't interchange things with my road bike, which is Altegra. Right.
Yep, and we spoke about it. I don't know, two podcasts ago, where I actually upgraded my gravel bike to the SRAM Force.
Yep,
but I have a mountain bike. You know, No. The
what was
the,
your brake?
Brake.
Right? Yeah.
So the brake caliper didn't fit. So I took a mountain bike brake caliper, fitted it in. Works perfectly with my SRAM 4. So you know exactly what you just said, Stuart.
And what's also interesting about this is they did some trickle down, which we see a lot of. Mm-hmm. You know, we see a lot of trickle down typically where they take things from red and move them down to Force, or in Shimano world, take it from Dura Ace and move it down to Altegra. But in this situation, we saw it trickle up as well. they adopted the levers. They adopted the brake hoods, and levers from Rival up to Force. Meaning they're a little bit thinner and whatever, right, but secret. They took the chain rings from the red and dropped them down into Force. Now that's good and bad, because the only issue with the chain ring in the red component is they're one piece units, mm-hmm. which is great from a strength and great from a lightness perspective. But what it means is when you have a worn out chain ring, you have to replace all of them at once, the whole thing at once. And if you have an integrated power meter, you have to replace the power meter at the same time as well.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, which mm-hmm. is a little bit on the, you got a worn chain ring, you end up having to replace your power meter. That's a little pricey, but it's the price of the price of having that one piece unit.
But
the only
again,
flip to the only flip though to that flop is that most people will never run through a chain ring. I think that they've said something like it's like 6,000 miles is your average chain ring usage. I don't know the actual, but it is something ridiculous.
Yeah.
So the average person will never wear through that unless you are one of the people who, you know, I'm going to upgrade to Force. I'm never going to change for the next 10 years. You will run through that. But for your normal person who uses it for 3, 4, 5 years max, before they upgrade to whatever the newest is, I don't think that we'll have the issues. And that's why SRAM said that they're comfortable with doing that, is because that was the number one complaint that, well, hell, if I want to go to a different chain ring, I need all new. Where I definitely can see it being a problem is different courses. If you're like where we are in Pennsylvania, where we could ride in Delaware, where it's almost perfectly flat, or we could ride up around State College, where it's a very, very big. Jack, have they talked at all about that? Do you, because it's one solid chain ring for both the small end chain. Right. Have they talked about how to address that? Is it just cassettes or anything? Have you heard about that?
No, I mean they are a one piece unit with an integrated power meter in that unit. So if you want to change your chain rings, you have to change both and the power meter. But again, that's where I think the variety of the componentry that they offer, because you can run a mullet setup with this, for example.
Yeah.
You can run an Eagle setup. So they're dealing with the different terrain via the cassette, not with the chain ring.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be my guess.
The, interesting.
The power meter is modular, right? You can upgrade. So if you don't have the power meter in your crankset, at least for the SRAM Force group set that I have, which is not the latest, I can still upgrade it and incorporate a power meter. I can buy the power meter. Let me put it like that.
Now, Jerry, is that a Quark you're buying? You would add on, or is that the SRAM? I mean, I know Quark is SRAM, but
I think it's a Quark, yeah.
Quark, yeah.
Yeah.
The same is here, but again, when you have the double chain rings, it's actually embedded in the chain ring unit.
Yeah.
Right.
Similar to how an SRM works, as I understand it, then it becomes part of the actual, you know, chain ring, spindle, the center part that like an SRM would be, that is where the power is.
Correct. So once
you comes out.
So you can start without a power meter and upgrade to a power meter, but you're buying the entire spindle.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's and your rear cassette is limited, obviously, to what type of rear derailleur you have. Because there is a maximum.
Actually, in this one, the one derailleur will handle all of the different variations.
Oh, okay.
So there isn't a long reach, long reach, short reach, or anything of that nature. The one derailleur, and I think that's the answer to Stuart's question: is one derailleur can handle their entire range of cassettes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
From what they're saying for now.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting, you know, and again, it's priced exactly as the old Force. It's got some new fancy graphics and colors, whatever. But the main difference is, I think, is it's, I wouldn't say it's a brand new group set, but I think it's a nice upgrade.
Yeah.
Very nice upgrade for version number 2. So let's keep on SRAM, since we've just talked about SRAM.
The good SRAM. Now we'll talk about the bad SRAM.
I don't know if it's bad. You know, this happens in business, right? So about two years ago, SRAM put a lawsuit against Princeton Carbon Works, saying that they infringed on their patent for the sawtooth wheel, you know, the Zip 454 carbon NSW wheels, you know, the ones that look really cool that they've got the sawtooth design on it. They, you know, those wheels are based on a patent from an inventor called Dimitrios Kastanis. He issued that patent in 2017 and a related one in 2020 that eventually SRAM acquired those patents. That happens fairly common in the business world. So SRAM acquired those patents, and those patents describe a rim with an undulating configuration that's supposed to reduce aerodynamic drag, specifically in crosswinds. And what I found interesting is that the shape of that wheel, the sawtooth design, was inspired by the hydrodynamic properties of a humpback whale flipper. So there's nature influencing the cycling world. Now, Princeton on the other side said, look, you know, that's great, but we really didn't, you know, if you look at their wheel, it looks a lot like the 454 NSW. But what they're basically saying is that, well, yeah, it looks like it, but it doesn't infringe on the patent because the wheels lack the convex exterior profile that's included in the patent. And as you can imagine, the judge said, all right, this, I can't deal with this. This has got to be a jury trial. So it went to jury. It was a 2-week trial, and it was basically a battle of the experts. You know, right. SRAM brought in their folks, and then, you know, Princeton brought in their folks. And after a 2-wheel trial, the jury
a 2-wheel trial?
Oh, yeah, 2-wheel. Yeah. Did I say that? Yeah, 2-wheel, yeah. Of course. A 2-wheel, a 2-week trial on 2 wheels. The jury did side with Princeton. So they.
That's good to see.
That's cool.
Not anything against SRAM, but, you know, SRAM, Shimano, they're the big companies. And if I would imagine if SRAM would have had their way and won it, that then. You know, it's Princeton Tech would have had a little bit harder of a hill to climb, or a little bit steeper of a hill to climb. So it's good to see Princeton Carbon Technologies to be able to win that lawsuit and hopefully carry on, because they do really, really awesome stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. They really do.
Yeah. Their wheels are beautiful.
Yeah. I was going to say, and it's nice to see some of the smaller guys. I mean, they're not small, but to see some of the smaller guys, you know, be innovative as they can be without concern about patent infringement. Now we could talk about how Shimano is treating SRAM with the, or treating Hammerhead with their DI2 functionality, but we'll save that for later podcast.
No, I think this last piece we're going to talk about with the new Continental tires is something I am oddly really, really excited about. Because this is a tire I have been awaiting. There's a new Continental, and I know this that tech is Jack's area,
but this
new Continental GP5000 all-season tubeless tire, I am geeked out about. I like to ride really long distances, and tires make a big difference. You know, it might be only 10 seconds for an hour, 5 seconds for an hour, but for 24 hours, you know, that's a lot of seconds to save. And this new Grand GP5000 all season tubeless tire, as well as a GP5000 TT tubeless, are coming to the family of the GP5000 family. And the all season is what it says it is. It's supposed to be a year round tire with more, thicker sidewalls than the standard GP5000.
I think it has 4 plies versus the GP5000S, which has 3, and the TT only has 2. So they added another layer.
Yeah. And if anybody really, really nerds out and is looking for a way to upgrade their nerd level, go to bicyclerollingresistance.com. It is a great website for actually, in all seriousness, if you're looking at different tires and you're a subscribing member, you can really look at different tires and the watts that they save or draw from you. And the GP5000 from Continental is consistently one of the fastest tires across the board. I have not seen either the AS or TT come up yet on this, but it's something that I've already asked every bike shop I know, can you order me this tire? The answer is no, I haven't heard of this tire yet.
So, well, one thing I hope they've addressed is that I like the GP5000. I've used it, but it's so hard to mount from a tubeless perspective. It's so hard to get mounted. So hopefully they make these just a little bit easier to get mounted. Cause I'm always worried that, you know, if I have a sidewall or something that I can't, you know, I can't fix on the road, I don't think on the road I could get that tire off. So I'm like making the call of shame. So that's the only issue I have with the GP5000s.
Looks like you need to get some inserts.
Yeah.
Just so if you fly, you can bike home.
Or stronger thumbs.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Monkey grip.
Right.
But back to the tire, though, it's supposed to be a fairly lightweight. They're claiming for the 20HC, which I think is what most people will be running, will be somewhere in that 340 grams for a very fast, lightweight-ish tire. That's pretty reasonable. It will be about $100. Maybe that's not reasonable, but I think that's what we pay for tires nowadays. Yeah.
It's the going price for a good tire. Yeah. It's going price for a good tire.
It is.
Yeah. And I'm surprised it's only, it's just marginally heavier than the GP1000, S. It's really only, 20 to 50 grams heavier, which is nothing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent stuff. So, this is a record, guys. We're at 1:20.
Ooh, 1 hour 20. Yeah.
So we're going to wrap it up. But if I say so myself, I think this was an awesome podcast. And I think we had a lot of really good talk. We talked about the races. We had some media stuff going on, the technology corner with all the, the group sets and the tires right now. Mm-hmm. And for next week, we'll probably talk more racing, right? But he just announced Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. We will scour all nooks of the internet finding new technology news. And we'll be actually planning to record a podcast, which is more like the interview style we had before with Brian Oberholzer. He is, what is his title, Jack?
He is the vice president for product development at Hammerhead.
Hammerhead. So if you don't know Hammerhead, they are the creators of the Karoo 2 bike computer. So we're really excited to have a chat with him and find out more about everything concerning bike computers and what that entails. Excellent stuff, guys. Have a great the rest of your evening. For the listeners, please like the podcast, like the YouTube, leave a review. Always
like it all.
And we'll talk to you again pretty soon. Thank you.
Thank
Have
you.
A good one, guys.
Bye.